Hello and welcome to Asia in Depth. I'm Matt Schiavenza. Today, another look at lessons learned during the coronavirus outbreak. Few places in the world have done a better job of suppressing the coronavirus than Taiwan. More than 3 months after a 50-year-old woman became the island's first case, only 6 people have died from the virus. In contrast, New York State, which has a similar population, has lost over 18,000 lives. What makes Taiwan's success even more remarkable is that it came despite the fact that it is only 100 miles from mainland China, where the virus originated, and despite the fact that it shares extensive economic links with the mainland. And Taiwan accomplished this feat without resorting to the economic shutdown seen in the United States and elsewhere. In this episode, we're going to take a closer look at what Taiwan got right and what this means for its future. Ciaru Shirley Lin is Compton Visiting Professor in World Politics at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. Dr. Chunhui Chi is Director of the Center for Global Health at Oregon State University. These two experts speak with Daniel Russell, Vice President for International Diplomacy and Security at the Asia Society Policy Institute. Dr. Chi begins the conversation by listing 4 main reasons for Taiwan's successful smothering of the virus.
I can summarize the 4 key policy response that helped Taiwan rather effective. Quoting the London's The Telegraph, Taiwan set the gold standard. And then last Sunday, the New York Post has an article said Taiwan is the only nation in the world that did the right thing against this pandemic. So the 4 main policy issues. The first one is Taiwan did a very advanced planning and advanced deployment. And probably a few countries did the preparation as early as Taiwan, and that dated back to 2003, because Taiwan was badly burned in 2003 and prepared. And at the end of 2003 SARS, Taiwan decided never again Taiwan should face a pandemic like that unprepared. So Taiwan had 16 plus a year to prepare that. And then Taiwan activated its command center even before Taiwan had its first case. And one of the magic is at that time, Taiwan already foreseeing the shortage of masks. So also consolidated, monopolized masks by the government and then prepared building new mask production line. And the second, a key policy success is Taiwan demonstrated what a good governance, particularly in democracy, can do. And the command center is a kind of ideal in the Latin word, the communitas, meaning put every administration in equal, but it's in a very transparent way to communicate. And people, as a result of that, the command center earned a huge trust among the public. No politician or public figure ever gets such a high approval rate. The commander, Dr. Chen, the Minister of Health, has a 92% approval rate in Taiwan. And then the third important background is because of the 2003 SARS experience, compounded by Taiwan has been internationally politically isolated. And that forged a major social climate of social solidarity, which is not easy because Taiwan just went through a highly divisive presidential election on January 11. And so that's kind of a magic phenomenon. And the last one is the Taiwan has a very advanced information technology that allowed Taiwan to do a very, very different way of containing the pandemic. Unlike South Korea or other nations did a mass testing, Taiwan did a precision tracking and testing that allowed Taiwan to very efficiently contain the pandemic.
Thanks for those are 4 interesting and important points: advanced planning, centralized government, coordinating process that won public trust, political solidarity, and advanced technology. I'd like to drill down a little bit on the technology part, if I could. I read in your article a reference to something called digital fence monitoring. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about how technology was applied in Taiwan.
It's a joint effort, collaboration between the government, the command center, with five major cell phone carriers. And the technology is based on the cell phone signals. And Taiwan require everyone who are under mandatory quarantine to download an app. And with that app, Taiwan can easily and clearly monitor people who are under quarantine, whether they violated quarantine. For example, that app will have the person under quarantine send out signal every 10 minutes. And if the command center did not receive the signal more than 20 minutes, they immediately contact local police and health official to visit the person. And then in the case the person violated the quarantine, went to public places, the command center will know where are those public places down to the day and time, and even for which public transportation that the person took. And then they immediately announce that if anyone visited those places, you have to watch careful for your symptom because you might have contact with the person who are infected. So that's how Taiwan can very precisely track and trace potential exposure and then test it, not the large population, but people who potentially have in contact with the confirmed patient.
Can I just add to that?
Please, Shirley.
On the technology front, yeah, I think that to add to what Junhui was saying, acting swiftly was very important. In that, of course, technology was extensively used. Over 55,000 smartphones basically were downloaded this app and tracked potential carriers of COVID-19, which effectively, of course, contained any further spread among the community. But I wanted to get back to also the fact that acting swiftly really set the foundation for Taiwan's success, which had all of the elements Junhui talked about. One of them, I think, is also very important, I would add, is transparency. And this is a lesson learned during SARS, where Taiwan had basically 181 deaths. And so every year, Taiwan was rehearsing for another pandemic. So the dissemination of information on prevention has also kept the citizens safe and informed. And I think that is something to note. The other thing I would add is that Taiwan was a key producer and exporter of masks. And that was also quite important because it was able to respond to ensure mass supply to the citizens, partially thanks to Taiwanese manufacturers who have moved back to Taiwan due to various reasons, both economic and political reasons from China in the last few years. So not only are all citizens insured of sufficient masks, and having been here throughout the pandemic in Taipei, we now get 9 masks every 14 days. I just went to get my 9 masks. But I feel sorry for saying that because actually we now are able to, using the app, click and donate all of the masks that I'm entitled to pick up and give it to the rest of the world. And this further helped the rest of the world fight the pandemic, widely considered called mass diplomacy. But originally it was after the government had donated 10 million masks, but today Taiwanese people have given more than 1 million masks away.
I want to comment that Taiwan was the first nation to implement universal access to masks.
Well, I want to come back later in the conversation to mask diplomacy and sort of the political dimension of it. But what comes through very loud and clear is the extent to which the authorities moved quickly, that they saw early on the need to take action and responded to that very fast. And I wonder, you know, to what extent does that mean that Taipei just didn't take Beijing's statements about the virus or its silence about the virus at face value? What was going on in late December when sort of rumors about a virus in Wuhan started to come out, but no hard and fast information? Chinwei, were you tracking that? Is that something that you saw?
Yes, one of the reasons John Hopkins predicted Taiwan would be the worst hot hit country outside China was based on last year, there were 7 million visits between Taiwan and China by Taiwanese alone. This did not include Chinese. And that frequent visit include over 500,000 Taiwanese businessmen, and together with their family, about 2 million live long-term in China. So that frequent visit give Taiwan an advantage of information because there are lots of Taiwanese in Wuhan back and forth. And that flight between Taiwan and nearby airport never stop, continue every day. So that give Taiwan an advantage of insider information. So Taiwan knew back in December, something wrong was happening. So Taiwan actually was the first nation to warn WHO on December 31st about this disease. But unfortunately, WHO kind of ignored, did not take any action. Also, Taiwan's action dated back to as early as the same day, December 31st. Taiwan was the first nation to implement an onboard inspection of all passengers from Wuhan to Taiwan. So December 31st was the first day Taiwan took action.
Wow, that's really important.
I'll just add to that, Danny, that of course, Taiwan as a country that hardly belongs to any international organization was going about looking at information in Wuhan carefully, but really not really being in any sort of collaborative effort. And so it was going at it alone with few diplomatic partners as well, and only 100 miles away from China with direct flights to Wuhan at the onset of the pandemic. So the threat that Taiwan faced in terms of healthcare, in terms of this pandemic, was much worse. I would say that the closest comparison is Hong Kong. It is really, there have been more than 700 Taiwanese who have evacuated, left Wuhan and returned with very little community spread after their return. And there are a few hundred more, but this is something quite astounding in terms of the distance and the measures they had to take. But I will add one unintended consequence of the political tension in the Taiwan Strait as having helped Taiwan fight the pandemic early on. Rising tension has unintentionally benefited Taiwan because China had been, since 2016, reducing the number of individual and group tourists coming from China to Taiwan. And in the weeks before the 2020 presidential election, in order to influence Taiwanese not to vote for the Democratic Progressive Party, which won in a landslide in the presidential and legislative election in January 2020, this restricted the flow of infected individuals from China to Taiwan, even before the government, of course, imposed border control. So you can see everything has a silver lining, perhaps.
Wow. So who knew that there would be a silver lining to Beijing's effort to put an economic squeeze on Taiwan in the run-up to the elections? That's pretty ironic. Well, Shirley, you mentioned Hong Kong. Junhui, you talked about the travelers and so on. And so let me ask you to help us kind of put this into perspective, put Taiwan's experience into perspective relative to the rest of the world. So it occurred to me that you take Australia, which is considered certainly in the United States to have done a very credible job in containing the virus. It's an island nation with a population of about 25 million people. It's about 4,000 or 5,000 miles away from China. They've had almost 7,000 cases and about 90 deaths. Taiwan is also an island. The population is virtually the same size. As Shirley mentioned, it's only 100 miles from the mainland. You gave the statistics about the tremendous number of visitors from the mainland, of Taiwanese who go or live there and come back and so on. And yet, Taiwan has had less than, I think, a tenth of the cases or the fatalities as Australia did. I mean, that's just one example, which is a little bit mysterious to me. I'm interested also in sort of Taiwan relative to other places as well. Maybe you could help us understand
talk about the Hong Kong and what I am particularly focus on, which is the United States, different states. And I know Junhui has the answer to the comparison with the rest of the world. Hong Kong, of course, has very few deaths like Taiwan, but the infection confirmed cases is 3 times that of Taiwan. But it's a city that is only a third of Taiwan's population. But of course, it doesn't have, it's not an island, and therefore it's much harder to contain. But if you look at, I think, two other examples that are similar to Taiwan in size, is New York State and Florida. Now, both have a population that are similar, not exactly to Taiwan, but Florida, which has been, of course, lifting its social isolation policy because it's done, quote, a good job, has now 33,000 cases and 1,200 deaths. That's 200 times the number of fatality in Taiwan. And New York State, where my children live, they have nearly 300,000 cases and 18,000 deaths. So I find that really astounding. And I'd love to hear from Junhui as to all the best comparative examples.
Well, I look at a little bit about those countries. So some of the figure I'm particularly interested, besides the total number of deaths, I'm also interested in the case fatality rate, meaning of people who confirm how many died, the percentage. And the case fatality rate in Taiwan is not the lowest because Taiwan has so few cases. And actually, for the few countries I look, Singapore has the lowest case fatality rate of 0.09%, mainly because Singapore has a large cases of 5.7 million population. Singapore has over 15,000 cases. Yet, Singapore was successful in keeping the fatality low, with total of only 14 deaths. So that puts Singapore probably the number one in terms of the lowest case fatality rate. Hong Kong also has a very low case fatality rate for the same reason with Singapore. Large number of cases, but few deaths. So Hong Kong's case fatality rate is only 0.39. And compared with that, Taiwan's case fatality rate is 1.4% because Taiwan has only 429 cases with 6 deaths. And Australia, despite has a huge number relative to Taiwan, it was relatively successful in keeping patient alive. So Australia's case fatality rate is slightly lower than Taiwan with 1.33%, mainly because it has huge number of cases. Contrast with that, New York State has 6.1% case fatality rate, and U.S. as a whole have 5.79%. Case fatality rate. And South Korea is also doing relatively good, has 2.29%. The other figure I look at is for every million population, how many cases they have. And this one, Taiwan led the world. Well, Taiwan has 18 cases per million, and South Korea has 209, and Hong Kong has 140. Singapore has 2,744. And the U.S. has 3,230, and New York State has 15,361. So this shows the relative scale of the prevalence.
Well, Shirley Chinwei, I'm a New Yorker, and you're not making me feel any better.
That's where you are now.
I'm in New York, yeah. So look, it's you know, Chinwei, you stressed the importance of the early start that Taiwan had. Well, it's too late for us to be early, right? It's late in the game right now. So are there things, practices that other countries can replicate that societies like ours in the US and New York can imitate, that would actually help us now at this point in the pandemic?
Yes, unfortunately, one of the wrong message that both WHO And U.S. leaders, including CDC and vice president and all level of health authority, as well as most European nations, for nearly 2 months, from WHO down to every national leaders and health authority has been telling people the wrong message, telling the general public, don't wear mask. Mask will not protect you. Whereas Taiwan, South Korea, and Hong Kong has from the beginning wearing mask. And my epidemiologist friend told me that in the absence of vaccine, when having the public wear mask serve the similar function of vaccine, you can cut off the spread. That's what the vaccine tried to do. And it took US and European countries until around second week of March to reverse that message, start to encourage. And LA City was the first city to mandatory mask wearing in most public places. And I'm hoping, well, some Americans are still confused because for 2 months, their leader tells them don't wear masks. And suddenly that's a reversal. It's hard to change. And I'm hoping as more people wearing masks in public places, it will cut off the spread. And on top of that, the contact tracing, testing, isolation, quarantine are important. And where Taiwan keep most things open, many indoor places actually require masks, especially school and public transportation. And that will be the measure that US and European country and any country consider to reopen economy need to take by requiring masks in most indoor public places and public transportation.
I wanted to add also to something that may not be as useful in terms of immediate policy impact, but I think it's very important to be said what could be done and what actually has Taiwan done well. I think more important than technology, manufacturing capability, or effective government policies, actually, what has allowed Taiwan to show the world it can work together as a community is one word, and it really cannot be done in the short term, but it must exist in the long term for any community or country to fight this pandemic, and that is trust. And the trust I'm talking about is not just a hierarchical trust, but it's trust between individual citizens, knowing that they're fighting this pandemic together. So I always wear a mask in Taipei, everyone does, especially now if you go into buildings. It became required only recently in many government buildings, but it's been the case since I've been here in January. So you observe social isolation, not for your own sake, but for the sake of your neighbors and for fellow Taiwanese. Trust between individuals and government so that you believe the data provided is real. Follow the guidelines and policy being promoted or enforced. And the government also trusts the citizens, and that's very important. So that it doesn't overextend efforts to enforce policies or try to prevent protests. If there's trust, there is a less cost associated with enforcing policy, and everyone makes sacrifices for the community. This is what my research on cross-strait relations is about. A sense of solidarity actually is much more pronounced when there is an external threat, in this case, COVID-19. But also there's a perceived threat from China, which has actively tried to block Taiwan from working with the WHO, even in this pandemic. And this sense of community reflects, of course, the strength, I think the resiliency of a democracy, which is one of the things people have been questioning. Is a democratic society able to fight the pandemic better? And I won't go into that yet. But I think that for those watching the recent elections in Taiwan, many people say it's a divided society. But as a country, it has a competitive, highly competitive political system, a very strong sense of social solidarity and national identity, especially when it is threatened and it comes together as opposed to falling apart.
Well, that's really, really interesting. And I'd like to kind of drill down a little bit on that if I can, because I certainly agree and recognize the value and the power of trust in a society. And I think it's admirable that Taipei was able to really build trust. The relevant ministers, as you both have mentioned, enjoy just, you know, spectacularly high approval ratings domestically. In contrast, on the mainland, Beijing got compliance from the public for very, very strict quarantine and other measures, you know, basically through political brute force. The party state used a combination of cutting edge surveillance and other technologies, along with old fashioned Maoist or Mao era mass mobilization tactics to enforce the guidelines. So in Taiwan, there was a sense of coming together, a sense of trust, but I keep coming back to the fact that in my experience, Taiwan is really a pretty fractious society. I mean, you yourself surely wrote very extensively about the sunflower protest movement, right? And you mentioned the national election in January. That was very, very hard fought. There are sharp divides between green and blue. There are ethnic, geographic, generational divides and so on. So here's a very, you know, here's a freewheeling democracy. Other democracies have really struggled and been unable to build a national consensus.
We're going to take a short break here to talk about a couple of upcoming members-only programs here at Asia Society. On Thursday, May 14th, Minjin Lee, author of the award-winning novel Pachinko, will speak with Asia Society Executive Vice President Tom Nagorski. And on Tuesday, May 19th, we'll be presenting our annual Osborne Elliott Prize for Excellence in Journalism in Asia, an award given to some of the world's most distinguished writers and reporters of the last two decades. To find out more about all the terrific benefits of membership at Asia Society, such as being able to watch these programs live, go to asiasociety.org/membership. And now let's get back to Siaru Shirley Lin, Chunhui Chi, and Daniel Russell.
Tell me a little bit more about how it was, what it was that allowed the authorities in Taipei to really cut past these divisions and create a unified sense of urgency.
I will just go straight to the question you posed about the sunflower movement as an illustration of the of what you're asking, Danny. I love to hear Junhui's thought about this. But I think the sunflower movement actually exemplifies in my book, as the last chapter, really what I'm talking about, which is a democratic society promotes openness and discussion and disagreement. That is aired honestly, competitively, and fairly. And the Sunflower Movement was organized among young people who felt actually as a community that Taiwan was threatened by China. And this is, of course, is after 2012, after Xi Jinping's ascent. Slowly but surely, there were changes, and that led to concerns about carrying on with the implementation and execution of the service trade agreement. So it's a separate topic that actually illustrates the same point, and is when the community, when a democratic community is threatened, it can actually result in the best that it could be. And the same thing happened when, for example, 9/11, after 9/11, I think that there were clear evidence that Americans felt more proud of being American and came together. And I think today Americans are trying to come together to fight the pandemic. But the pandemic raises the question of which actually system is better in managing the economy, a better system of government. So the U.S. has led a liberal order, which is founded on promoting democracy. And that is what's being challenged by Beijing's leadership, some believe. This COVID-19 pandemic is another test of which system may serve its people better. Now, there's a long-standing dilemma, of course, when you look at the two systems. Do people want more freedom and privacy, or are they, which are more likely to be given in the democratic system, or more security and stability, which are given to the majority in an authoritarian system, which I think a lot of people feel that are more effective, effectiveness and equity and fairness. There are all these different trade-offs. So I think that it will be beneficial for the world to know actually how Taiwan has done it as a democratic community. And I think that it has shown that it has more, there's more solidarity in crisis.
Can I pick up on that point with both of you. One of the questions that came in from YouTube, this one from Uma, is how the public reacted to on privacy issues when required by the government to share all this personal data on the app. Was that a point of contention within Taiwan society?
That issue was hardly contested, mainly because of the trust. Most Taiwanese people, particularly based on their experience from SARS, they knew this is an unusual situation. This is an exception. And we need to sacrifice a little bit of that privacy. And besides, that's not for the enrichment of the privacy is not for everyone. It's only for those people who are under mandatory quarantine. And government also explained those location data you are already given up to your cell phone carrier. And Google also has that. Facebook also has that. So if people are willingly giving up their privacy to private company, why not, especially in the case of emergency, for the sake of public safety, give up a little bit of privacy? So from my observation, there was very little debate in Taiwan about this.
Let me shift gears for a moment, if I could. Both of you have mentioned the WHO, and I think there's a lot to unpack here. But I wonder, Shirley, would you be willing to give the audience just the very basic overview of Taiwan's relationship or lack of relationship with the WHO and how the PRC has factored into that?
Okay, I'll be brief in the background, but many viewers will probably know the issue quite well from the headlines in the last 2 weeks. Some people believe that international organizations have been politicized, and that there's a perception that Beijing has had an increased role in extending its influence, so that multilateralism is being undermined. And these organizations, which ostensibly should exist to improve the welfare of human beings, sort of what has happened is running against the basic mission of the World Health Organization. Now, Beijing has limited Taiwan's ability to work with the WHO, not only restricting the effectiveness of this critically important organization, but also sending a message to people of Taiwan that does not promote the sense of solidarity between the Chinese and Taiwanese, whom Beijing claims to be compatriots. That's at the cross-strait relations level. Now, at the international level, since it left the United Nations in 1971, Taiwan has not been a member of the World Health Organization. Under the One China policy, the United Nations and the WHO do not accept Taiwan as a member because of Beijing's objections. However, when President Ma, who was seen as being more pro-China, was elected in 2008 and returned to the 92 consensus, which implied both sides set unification as their ultimate goal, Taiwan was permitted to be an observer for about 7 years until the election of Tsai Ing-wen of the DPP in 2016. Furthermore, under a secret MOU signed between the PRC and the WHO in 2005, Taiwan's participation in the WHO, even in a healthcare emergency, which could be defined as COVID-19, it's ambiguous, but this has been conditional upon Beijing's mission to the UN agencies in Geneva and the Chinese Foreign Ministry in Beijing approving any kind of participation, even in technical meetings, by Taiwan, which effectively means that Taiwan often, even when it was able to participate in very few meetings, it would get the invitation hours before you need to get to the meeting, and it's too late. So Taiwan was not able to do anything. Now, this time around with the pandemic, the absurdity of the situation has been further accentuated because Taiwan has not been able to get data except through China, and China is supposed to send people to Taiwan, of course, which has not happened. And people, I think in general, the world is saying, is this an example of China extending its influence, not by funding international organizations like WHO, but by developing bilateral relationships, in this case with Ethiopia, where Tedros, the director general, was the health minister and seemed to be under increasing pressure from the very start to take China's position. Now, this is the background of the WHO controversy. And the most recent bid, I'll leave the interpretation to you both, but the recent bid, of course, is Taiwan then has been working more closely with the US during the pandemic. And last Friday, just a few days ago, a virtual meeting between Taiwan's Minister of Health and Welfare and the US Department of Health and Human Services, a secretary of the US Department of Health and Human Services took place, where the US seems to support Taiwan's participation in some form in the WHO.
One of the online questions, Shirley, is to that point precisely, what are the prospects of Taiwan getting some sort of special dispensation in the future in order to be able to participate in World Health Organization or World Health Assembly work?
I think this is why the virtual meeting was very important, because the annual meeting is coming up. But I like to actually ask a question to Junhui. How important, yes. Some people say actually the WHO may not be so important anymore because Taiwan didn't belong to it and was able to fight the pandemic. While I think WHO serves still has an important function to play. And I wonder what Junhui thinks.
Right, what it means in terms of public health and also just how you view it as a medical professional.
Yes, for nearly two decades, Taiwan has been struggling to try to participate in WHO without much success. But this pandemic kind of shifted both Taiwan's perspective and position, because for nearly two decades, Taiwan's request to rejoin to participate WHO was not to be left out in important information, important collaboration. Taiwan need help from WHO. But because of the success of Taiwan's control of this pandemic, and actually some would comment, and I agree, Taiwan this time benefited from not being a member of WHO because of WHO's both slow response and wrong information. And so Taiwan didn't suffer from that. And I even have some professional friend in Taiwan said this. They said, well, Taiwan being the most successful country in defending this COVID-19 is actually a big embarrassment for WHO. And some would even argue Taiwan should not join WHO at this time because of all the problem Sherry talked about. And so Taiwan has changed its perspective as well as position. Increasingly, Taiwan is reversing the plight that instead of Taiwan need WHO's help, now Taiwan is saying, we can help WHO, we can help the world. So that has a big change of attitude and perception.
Well, that is really an interesting point and quite an ironic turnabout.
Add to what Junhui is saying, Danny, I think you asked the question, what are the prospects? And I guess I would avoid answering that because making forecasts so close to the date is quite dangerous. But I would say in terms of what should be, it's very clear that Taiwan is an important part of the world, especially in fighting the pandemic. And more than ever, we need countries to come together, to collaborate, to find not only a way to treat, but to find a vaccine. And Taiwan can absolutely be part of this community and help other countries figure out creative public policy and effective way to govern. So I think that there is no doubt that very rarely has Taiwan been in the news for, I think, being a model to the world. And as one of my friends, Shelley, would go to say, as an end in itself, in sort of Taiwan effectively governing for the benefit of the Taiwanese and for their health, and also to be a responsible member of the global community to help the world. So I think there's no doubt that Taiwan deserves to be in, to be participating in the WHO.
One of the questions that is coming in online from a number of people has to do with the economy and the economic impact of the COVID virus and the countermeasures as well. And so our viewers are asking, both how Taiwan has been dealing with the sort of tug of war, the zero-sum dynamic between heavier focus on prevention and health versus a heavier focus on preserving and protecting the economy. And also we've got questions simply about the very basic question of what's the extent of the adverse economic impact thus far in Taiwan, both from the local as well as from the global fallout.
Well, I would leave the economic question for Sherry. I just want to comment about the concept of the zero-sum game between protecting the public safety versus economy. And in fact, Taiwan has demonstrated that it is possible to minimize the impact, the negative impact on the economy by doing a highly competent job in protecting public safety. So the two are not contradictory to each other. It is when the government, the society is not able to protect the public safety that the government have to sacrifice the economy. So I would see that as a different way to put it. And that's what I have been strongly advocate in my numerous interview by journalists. How can we reopen the economy? And the only way to reopen the economy is by putting more resources to contain the spread of the disease so we can reopen the economy early. So this actually complement each other. And because Taiwan is so successful relative to, despite its economy also suffered a little bit, but relative to other country, Taiwan has probably the minimal negative impact on its economy.
I guess I'm more pessimistic, Danny, in terms of the trade-off, but I agree with Zhonghui. I don't think, and I think Cuomo said this well, it's not either or. Death is not an either or question. We have to survive. And so I don't think that it's the economy for controlling the pandemic. We have to control the pandemic for to survive. And I just want to start off, before I get into the economy, to say that while Taiwan remains open and normal, I'm very cautiously optimistic about what will happen. Restaurants and businesses stay open, but the risk of another wave of the virus spreading is always there because the world is global and Taiwan is an important part of the global supply chain. My mother had run a successful French restaurant in Taipei in 2003 with the home that I grew up with. During SARS, I remember clearly how the business improved so dramatically during the pandemic because everybody wanted to find a high-end restaurant that was clean because they weren't going to just stay home. But this ironically led to my mother facing the dilemma and she shut down the business and fired, lay off all the workers because she was worried everybody was going to catch SARS from increasing business. So as a way to start talking about the economy, we can't take it for granted that we move from a pandemic to a sort of economic recovery when it's over. I think that the fact that a pandemic is like an economic, like a financial crisis. And in the coming months, I think that this will test the sense of solidarity that I talk so much about. In fact, I'm quite concerned because eventually this will be tested as the economy, which grew 2.7% in 2019, one of the highest among high-income economies in Asia, is estimated to decline 4% this year. That is dramatic. Now, that is dramatic as a slowdown in bigger economies like China, which is facing its own challenges. So everybody is going through the same pain. But the government has already initiated relief measures in terms of fiscal stimulus, giving out vouchers, subsidies, benefits for needy groups, the unemployed. But how much are people willing to sacrifice their own well-being in the process of redistribution of benefits? There's limited amount of resources, and we're going to have to decide how to help different groups. And there's already a lot of controversy in the U.S. with some of the measures being carried out, and likewise here with what the DPP had decided to do against what I think some of the legislators and leaders in the KMT were proposing. So unemployment is going to rise, and I think the community as a whole is going to have to see consensus on policy to revive the economy. We don't have a lot of time here, but I would say that the changing global supply chain, especially in Asia, vis-a-vis China, is going to hit Taiwan very hard presenting both opportunities, but for the short term, many more challenges. While I just talked about Taiwanese businesses returning to Taiwan, it's not as if their return actually immediately improved the business environment and their profitability. I think everyone's going to suffer from decline in demand and this the reconfiguration of the supply chain. And so I think that the government is going to step in, and that leads to a final question. The state will become more important in many parts of the world and Taiwan as well. Now, is that something actually people are looking forward to? I remain cautious about that.
Thank you, Shirley. We have moved into overtime now. This has been such an exciting and interesting conversation. But before we wrap up, let's do a lightning round because we're getting online the very same question that I've been wanting to ask about the elephant in the room, China. And for Chinhui, my question is, what credibility do you think China's numbers have when it comes to coronavirus? How believable are they, particularly when the party declared victory and suddenly the numbers began dramatically to drop? And for you, Shirley, also lightning round, could you just share a little bit of your instinct and thoughts about what the longer-term impact of COVID-19 may be on cross-strait relations? But Chinhui, please start.
Yes, actually, I'm not alone. I don't trust the figure China reported. And quoting Dr. Gabriel Liang, who is the dean of the Faculty of Medicine at University of Hong Kong, back in February in a press conference when he was asked about China's figure, he said his team has done an estimation and simulation, and he said the China's reported figure, we should multiply at least 30 times. That's the word from Gabriel Liang. And on top of that, who is deciding how many number to report? In China, that's the Communist Party, not the health officials. And for a period of time, my friend noticed in Taiwan that for more than a week, this was back in late January and early February, every day China reported new cases and new fatality. And then one of my friends noticed that they have a magic number. No matter how many new cases China report, and no matter how many new deaths China report, their case fatality rate came to exactly the same. So that has to be massaged. And also there are some international organizations, they reported two world figures. One is the general world figure, including China. The other is the world figure without China. And most people would trust the world figure without China because many people by now don't trust the number China reporting. And that's unfortunate. And even Chinese people don't trust the number their government are reporting.
Thanks. Shirley, on cross-strait relations.
Danny, it's very interesting. The pandemic, everyone says, is a game changer. I personally don't subscribe to that at all in terms of cross-strait relations or U.S.-China-Taiwan relations. And that's because I think it actually accentuates the trends that are already existing for quite some time. In both relations, cross-strait relations, or as I said, the trilateral relations. As a democracy under attack, basically, facing China day in and day out, the pandemic is yet another episode of Taiwan potentially becoming weaker. And if it doesn't withstand this challenge, there will be severe consequences. Taiwan cannot afford, to ever, if you will, be fractious. The stakes are too high. And so Taiwanese are quite sensitive to these issues. And one example is, of course, fake news, which has been promoted by China. Now, to learn to fight the virus, resist misinformation, and trust official information, there's a lot of training in this the Taiwanese voters and people have because of the onslaught of misinformation being spread by China-based sort of originated news. So early on, of course, for example, there were flights from China which had carry people back from Wuhan. And there were rumors that there were people who were deliberately infected on those flights that were being sent on the plane to come and infect the Taiwan. But why would there be rumors like that? And people believe that, of course, because many people believe that Taiwan, if Taiwan does not fight the virus well, China should be able to take it over more easily. Even if China is under the pandemic, it will still view this as a very important opportunity. So with any kind of crisis, Beijing will continue to coerce Taiwan with disinformation, interference, and increased military activities in the Taiwan Strait. And some are worried that Beijing would take advantage of American weakness and distraction to further its goal of unification with Taiwan. So the pandemic, I think, is just further showing the trend of increasing competition between the U.S. and China, and also the increased tension in the Taiwan Strait. So I think the ultimate rivalry, of course, is not really the specific issues of trade, technology, or military, but again, competing on whose government system, which system of governance is more effective.
That'll do it for this week's episode of Asia in Depth. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube, and check out past episodes on our show page at asiasociety.org/podcast. And a reminder, wherever you are, to stay safe. We're in this together. I'm Matt Schiavenza. See you next time.